Of course, he's a world-class rider, but he is not exceptional on the power outputs that he delivers in a fresh state. We have sometimes better riders in the team.
Zone 2 training is something that's received quite a lot of high-profile attention.
If we had to do only Zone 2 training within our team...
Is there any way of like adapting your training to like be prepared for this?
Can you do it for 12 weeks? Your oxygen carrying capacity on the HB miles and things, it goes up. It almost doubles with some people.
Christoph de Kergel plays a key role at Alpecin De Koning. As you may already know if you've been watching any of the recent Zwift Academy episodes on the channel. He has helped the likes of Matthew Van Der Poel and Jasper Philipsen amass some huge results on the world's biggest stage. He's a coach, first and foremost, and has spent well over a decade at the forefront of professional cycling, helping support some of the world's biggest riders. His team has just started the 2025 race season, and in this video, I thought it would be the perfect time to catch up with him and pick his brains on some of the best coaching practices in 2025. See what insight I and you might learn.
Christoph, thanks so much for joining us today. I think just to start off, can you let everyone know what your role is in professional cycling?
Head of performance of Alpecin De Koning, of the team of Mathieu van der Poel and Jasper Philipsen mainly. I dived into that role as a cycling coach, as a real coach, but the last years my role just changed a little bit more towards more the managing function of what coaching is. So just putting out structures to make sure that the riders can perform as good as possible. And I'm supported there with a great team of coaches to help all this kind of work done. A modern team now these days is a big machine. There are hundreds of staff people involved, from doctors to nutritionists, to scientists, to whatever, coaches. So it's quite a big machine to get this all centralized a bit and to make sure that the right information gets to the athlete, and also not more than that, because they still need to be athlete and focus on their part of the job.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's actually leading on to my next question, because I think pro cycling has come a long way in the last few decades. You must have witnessed the changes that have been going on. Has your kind of like overall training philosophy changed at all as you've seen these changes, and perhaps as cycling has become more professional?
By getting a bit older and as a coach, and I need to make sure that I don't sound very old now, because I'm not that old yet, but after, let's say, 15 to almost 20 years in the sport, when you come in as a real sports scientist, you had your studies, you had someone, I know all these small things and I know how the body works and it's nice and it's whatever. You have to move a little bit from that scientific environment towards a more central role as a coach, in my opinion. I have the impression that I started as a coach when the power number just came up. I just had a few years on heart rate monitoring, to say it that way. And then the power meter just was commonly at a certain moment. And then that focus and maybe over focus was on that power meter. And scientifically, as a coach, and you're just into those numbers. The last 5 years, I feel with myself that I am easier on all those things, and you just try to back off a little bit, try to keep an overview on the global performance of an athlete, and then you notice that it's not only numbers in the global picture of performance. Of course, I am still a fan of numbers, and you have to it is a crucial thing, but it's not the only holy grail, like some. And that's maybe a bit the thing with younger athletes now coming in. They lost a little bit the subjective feeling on what racing is, or what cycling is, what riding a bike is sometimes.
That's really interesting. And I've heard other coaches say that to me as well. It's an interesting psychological take, actually, how numbers can influence your performance. And so taking that into account, what would you say is your kind of like overall training philosophy? If you were trying to kind of package up advice to a rider, what is that?
Yeah, there are only a few things that you just need to, take into account. And that's, on one way, you have the consistency. I think consistency is a very important principle. Make sure that your training is consistent and that it is. Yeah, we always talk about the 80-20% rule. Make sure that you can keep up with your ambitions.
When Christoph is talking about 80-20 here, he isn't talking about polarized training. A training method where 20% of your total training load is at an intense effort level and 80% is easy. Instead, he's talking about a philosophy of approaching life and racing, spending 80% of your time fully focused and 20% of your time in the year allowing yourself to relax in your approach to training and racing. Even pros are human, and the aim of this is to keep things fresh, avoiding burnout.
We are, and that's what we just talked about, we are no machines. Sometimes we look at, if you look at Mathieu or Tadej, you sometimes think that you are watching a machine. But in the end, behind the performance, there are still human beings, which are genetically 99% the same as us two here. But we cannot forget that. It's really important that we just keep looking at that global thing. So make sure if you have a goal and you set your goal, work towards it in a consistent way, because in training we know that the structure, the repeatability, the frequency of your training, it's very important that you can just hold up to that 80% of good work and 20% of not being a machine and being human. So that means, if you do all things 80% right for certain periods of the time, then you have also the right 20% to just ease it off a little bit as an athlete. And you see that also in the periodization of modern cycling. Now we work in quite short cycles towards something very specific, and then we ask the full attention of the rider. And then after that, I have something like he's in the 20% zone. Do it easy. Also for the non-professional athlete, sometimes I just have to say, try the 80%, 80-20% rule a little bit on the training, on the nutrition, on the sleep, because they start with a goal, they are over-motivated, they want to go all in 110%. And 6 weeks later, they have something like, I need to go to the pub because I cannot hold this. And then they destroy everything with one weekend.
That's good advice. And I can see that. I think it's when you push yourself so close to the limit, if you do that every single day all the time, it's going to catch up with you, isn't it? No, it doesn't matter who you are.
Indeed. I don't think anyone is capable of. I haven't seen any athlete over the years. We all need to go back to a certain moment, to a certain balance. And if you know that, it's good to know that at the start, to do it consistent, good frequency, good structure, specific tasks. Indeed, those are all a bit the main principles that you try to explain to the athlete, but try to set that balance immediately right. And that's actually what we try to do also as coach, and what I try to do as a main coach in the team, to try to predict that balance with certain athletes. Because when they see their program at the start of the year, they are all overexcited, like, I think I can do that and that. But then it's up to us to think like, but if we bring that athlete on the altitude camp and then straight to that race, he probably didn't thought that he is then that long away from home in November. They don't think about that. And when the situation is there in March, it's like half. I'm physically good after the altitude camp, but mentally I'm a bit broken. Then trying to perform with that balance So that are all things that are really important.
And just talking about that periodization and trying to like make sure that riders are peaking at certain times of the year, let's just like look at it from that structure. How does a rider's year take shape? And I guess like most importantly, how many peaks do you think is possible for a rider to have?
We always start to see, okay, as a coach, you just check your own rider quality. Like, okay, this is the squad which I have to play with. And then you look at your goals. What are the specific races? Okay, which kind of players can I put in which kind of race where we have the highest chance of success? That's already a really important thing also for non-professional cycling. People always need to ask themselves, is a certain goal for me, is it realistic? Does it suit with my capabilities? Because, yeah, so much people just ride into a big disappointment, which we could predict already even before they started. So based on your own genetics, body, whatever, choose things where you have the feeling of success a little bit. It's a quite important advice. If you are over 100 kilos, yeah, don't catch a climbing goal in the Tour de France as a non-professional, but then, yeah, catch a Paris-Roubaix goal can be a nice success thing. So the goal question is the first question that you ask yourself, and then you try to pair that, yeah, towards your own rider qualities, and then you divide that in some kind of team periodization, where I think in modern cycling, we typically try to have two main peak periods a year, because you see that with a lot of riders, they are just there for 6 weeks and then they are gone, and then 3 months later they are there again for 6 weeks. But if you are only racing two times 6 weeks a year, then I think the sponsors want you to be good in those 6 weeks.
There must be a huge amount of pressure on a rider with that structure and on the team around the rider.
I have the impression as a coach that cycling became physically better than it was a few decades ago. But mentally, I sometimes ask myself, is this now making the careers longer? The way modern cycling is going, because we do it physically nice and we track the riders well, and then that's all quite okay in my opinion. But mentally, I have sometimes questions about it, because as you say it puts a lot of pressure on that specific period where the preparation is there and where you ask 100% of the rider in that preparation. And when that racing block of 6 weeks is there, yeah, then it's money time. If you race each other 1 year round, okay, yeah, then if you do two or three good things in that year, which is a fair chance, then all is fine. But when they come from that mountain and they know like, okay, yeah, now we are in that period, then there are actually no excuses. It has to happen. The rider knows it himself. The team environment feels it. Yeah. And then the bigger environment, crowd, yeah. So social media things around are also making all things bigger, in my opinion, than it was a few years ago. So yeah, the mental pressure and also the mental efforts on the motivation, which we ask from a rider to train very specific from day to day, to eat according a food app and things like that. Yeah, it asks some kind of mental things, dedication. Yeah, riders who are going on to Terre for weeks or Sierra, it's not that it's so nice to be there at your own for weeks.
Yeah.
Some people should actually do it once just to have the experience of being on your own.
It's living like a monk, really. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
And I think, just leading on from that, I mean, any race is always cutthroat. Like any of the bigger races that I did, positioning is cutthroat. It's like every man for himself, really, once you get into it. But do you think, like, it's been spoken a lot about in the media, the increase in crashes that we're seeing over the last few years. Do you think that kind of plays a part in that, how there is such a lot of pressure on these few specific races that it is like kind of all or nothing?
I think we have to admit and say yes. As said, everybody knows at a certain point that it is money time. And they all target those smaller sections, specific races. It has to happen there. And then you see sometimes athletes, when it didn't happen in those 6 weeks, yeah, then they make their season a bit longer to try to catch something on the victories. But the thing is, when you risk that, yeah, the preparation is a bit gone, because then your eventual second peak, because you keep racing. So you have to have bigger balls in modern cycling, I guess, to really make specific targets and to say like, hey, we go for those races. At a certain moment, that was really something we also decided into the team when we were quite, we started from out of the Corendon Circus thing and then build it slightly up. Yeah, when you can perform from out of an underdog position, yeah, you can, all that you win then is a bonus. So the smaller races, yeah, you win, okay, yeah, and it's all nice. At a certain moment, you have to decide, okay, if we want to try to win the biggest events, then we have to sacrifice those smaller races a bit onto, for example, a specific altitude preparation to try to win the bigger events. But okay, we all know it's a big risk, eh? Because there are only 5 big events if we talk about monuments, and let's say 10 big races which are important from our team perspective in that first part of the season. Yeah, that's not a lot of opportunities. And it can be gone with one crash or one injury, sickness, whatever. If you get a cold a few days before the start of those top goals. So yeah, that puts pressure not only on the rider, but I think on the complete team perspective. And it's a bit of, I think it's important to explain that to everybody who is just watching how cycling works a bit. Because if we explain those things, it lowers the pressure a little bit, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, it's super interesting. I think as well, when you talk about professional cycling, there's so many variables as well outside your control that can go wrong. It's like you said, just one big crash, one like puncture at the wrong moment, and yeah, anything can happen. There's a lot outside your control. But just looping back to, I know you said that like, numbers, power isn't something you focus on as much as perhaps you used to. You obviously do still use power. What are the kind of key metrics you're tracking? Like what are you looking at when you do delve into the numbers?
Yeah, let me make it clear. I focus less on it than I was, because I was focused 110% on it when I was just from school, to say that way. But it is still the first thing that we do, and quite important. Yeah, cycling, it became also because of all the thing, the equipment, the bike, whatever, all things, all those details, they are just that high end now. It goes so quick towards a sprint, whatever. So it's all about the details that we just have to talk about. What are the decisive efforts still in cycling? Because every pro rider, yeah, has an FTP of 5.5 watts a kilo, eh? Which is, if you tell that to non-professional cyclists, it's, and you calculate that number to your own body weight, it's quite a number. But if you are in a world tour race and you are just putting out 400 watts for 10 minutes and you just look next to you, they are all still there, eh? So it's quite crazy. So that is not compared to in my opinion, 10 to 12 years ago, that is now not a decisive effort anymore. And it used to be at some point. So now we really look at, from our team perspective, we are not a climbing team, so we don't look the longer efforts. We are really onto the 5-minute effort, the 1-minute effort, and the sprint effort, 20 to 10 seconds. And if you see how those numbers changed or whatever, like on a 1-minute power, you should be around 12 watts a kilo to make it decisive. You have not a real fair chance in the World Tour if you don't get it up to those 12 watts a kilo. And don't forget, after a certain effort, that's another thing. If you then check monuments, there are 5,000 to 6,000 on the energy expenditure is already gone there before you have to just try to put those numbers out.
So you'd want someone to be able to do 12 watts a kilo or upwards for a minute after 6,000 kilojoules.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. Then you are really into decisive moves. And if you, depending on the race, if you see that to a 5-minute effort, if you are not above the 7 watts a kilo there, you will also not be in the decisive split normally. Those are crazy numbers. And if we talk about really a winning sprint move and you just try to check the 10-second value there, then it's over 20 watts a kilo there. Which is also, that means if the sprinter is about 70 kilos, 70 to 72 kilos, it's over 1400 towards 1500 watts.
And is that
10-second peak?
And is that those numbers there that you're speaking about, is that like professional standard or is that an exceptional like race winning pro?
That's race winning pro. I think that is being in the decisive, we call it then you are in the decisive split. So if it splits on the Poggio, the good split, and just not into the good split, it happens there around that 5-minute number, which we just talked about. The same with the sprint. If you want to end up in the top three of a Tour de France sprint, then you have to aim to that 20 watts a kilo for 10 seconds. Otherwise, the chance of being in the top three is very small. And then within that top three, we know then you have a fair chance with 20 watts a kilo to be in the top three. And then the rest is just, timing, a bit of luck. That's the other thing of real racing, then it's not the numbers. But the chance that you are there with 16 watts a kilo is in the top three, then you have to have a lot of luck to say it that way. So that's a bit how we have to approach it. And in the classics and in the punchy finals, like Ed, they now announced that the Kauberg is back in the Amstel this year. Well, yeah. There you have to have a 1-minute value of over 12 watts a kilo, and then you are for sure there. And if you then do a good sprint 1K further, fair chance.
I mean, these are like really short, punchy numbers to be putting out 5 minutes and below. How is there any way of like adapting your training to like be prepared for this?
Well, there is a way, but we also have to say it that way. It's easier. This is hard. So we always look for profiles from our team perspective. We work on that classics and punchy decisive moves. But it's easier if a rider has that kind of talent, where you just see like, hey, he has a very nice 5 minute, 1 minute, and a sprint, yes or no, I punch, whatever, quality. Then it's mainly easier to train his aerobic capacity up and to make sure that he, after a few years of aerobic training, he just gets those same numbers again after a certain kilojoules. The other way around is harder. If you have a real diesel, to say it that way, just a good engine, a guy that's a very good guy to keep up the pace, to do the control and in the start of the races. Strong guys, those have always a good recovery also, so you can take them into many stage races. They are very, the real domestic riders are very important, so we cannot underestimate them. But there is actually almost no way to make them a winner physically. And then we are not talking about the mental aspect of winning, which is something even completely different. But it's hard. So you just try to, sometimes we try to shift those domestics a little bit on the anaerobic capacity, because we want them to survive one or two decisive splits somewhere in the mid part of the race. Because that's exactly what some teams do. They try to kill the control guys early enough with 100Ks to go, that a team is, if you lose as a team, strong control guys, but you lose them with 150Ks to go in a monument, when you lost them, you lost them. Eh?
And is that kind of like aerobic threshold, is that FTP, is that still something you look at then when you're looking at riders, or is it purely on those shorter efforts?
We still look at it for sure, because there is a lot to do about FTP. And then actually, if you sometimes read it, we all still don't know quite well what it actually is. There are so many small definitions. So sometimes it's hard for as a normal cycling fan, whatever, to say, okay, what is now actually FTP? But we still use it, because it's still the one-way metric to hang on a certain structure on, because your normalized power, your kilojoules calculation, it's all just hanging on to it. So the food app nutrition thing, it's all just based on that a little bit, the training zones, whatever. So at some point we still use it. Of course, we have a lot of physiological tests which we do with the riders based on lactate to individualize their zones and their FTP more than the general thing of FTP is capable of, but in my opinion it's still a good one-way metric to use as a base to structure your training a bit and to set your training zones.
I'm also hearing a lot about fatigue resistance. We touched on it a second ago, putting out those power numbers at the end of like 6,000 kilojoules of work. How much of that do you take into account in terms of training and looking at riders?
Yeah, that's very important. Very important, because, and there I gave already a few times the example of Mathieu van der Poel. He is, of course, he's a world-class rider, but now I don't say anything new. But he is not exceptional on the power outputs that he delivers in a fresh state. We have sometimes better riders in the team where you see like, oh, he has, when you just have a 5-minute power of that rider when he's completely fresh, it's crazy. But the capability of delivering that same power output after 3,500 minimum to 4,000, 5,000 kilojoules in a monument. That is probably the biggest advantage of an athlete like Mathieu. So for sure, that is something we are always looking after. But that takes a few years. You always, when you have a certain, because we are always on the young talents, all teams are trying to scout as soon as possible the riders, where you have something like, hey, his capability of putting out energy in a fast way, in a possible decisive way, and then we talk about that 5 minute or shorter. If we can train that guy aerobically up, that he can do the same after at least 3,500 kilojoules, then we are something.
Yeah, it's quite like, it makes it more polarized, doesn't it? Because there's like a few riders really that can win, and it's all in for those riders.
It's indeed completely polarized, and you can ask yourself sometimes the question. Yeah, you have those 10% of riders who all win the races. Yeah, I have a real big appreciation for the riders who cannot win the races, who know it in advantage, and be very dedicated to their job and just do their job, to do their part of the puzzle and get motivation out of that. If you should ask the real winners, if they should live 1 month like a domestique, they would, I think, 70% of them quit cycling.
This is a good thing in cycling, or do you think it's maybe something that needs to be thought of more in terms of, you know, changing the team sizes, changing how the race is organised? Like, do you think we're losing the spectacle in a way by making it more predictable? Tough question.
It is a tough question. It's for sure more predictable. Okay, we also have to say that the 10% who is now winning the races, those are, yeah, almost heroes. So they make the prediction of it. They still make a spectacle of it, I guess. But it's important to just point out one time that the domestic riders, the non-winning riders, for sure, it's important to say to those riders, hey, they are professionals, they are dedicated, they work really hard. We try to give them always very specific roles and tasks within the team. And if you then have good leaders who win races or who or also respect the performances of those domestics, yeah, of course, that helps quite a lot.
Let's just talk about testing procedures now. Like, what are the kind of testing protocols that you use with riders on your team, for example? And like, how what shape does that take throughout the year?
In general, we have one just metabolic test once a year, but that's really at the start of the year, where they have their cardio testing pure medically, and when we have a traditional VO2 max test with the face mask and whatever, just to have a starting measuring point. But actually, training based, we only do field testing. We try to stay as close as possible into the field on the bike in real circumstances, with the power meter on the bike, because that gives us the best transferable metrics and data towards real training and real racing. Actually,
guess those results aren't on Strava.
Some are closed. It depends a bit. Sometimes the riders just want to put something on Strava.
And how much of a role does lactate testing play? Is that something you do a lot of? Like, I've seen it being used a lot more throughout pro cycling in general.
Yeah, we do it a lot because, as said, we talked about FTP in a general way. Good thing, first thing to catch up, get your structure. But yeah, professional riders, we have to handle them as an individual. And they are all very specific, very individual on their reactions onto training and whatever. So for some athletes, based on the periodization, you can have 4 to 5 field tests a year in those preparations. So mainly when we have training camps or altitude camps, you always have some kind of field testing integrated into it at the start, end, whatever, midway. To get their physiological profile, you try to map it as exactly as possible. And we need lactate sampling to take that into account as good as possible. It's just a matter of gathering as much data as possible and try to compare also a lot of things within the riders from season to season also.
And one thing, I've read that lactate testing can help with is like making sure you're training in the right zone, of course, and at the right intensity. Zone 2 training is something that's received quite a lot of high-profile attention recently. What are your thoughts on zone training, zone 2 training? Because it's interesting how you've described these really short, punchy efforts and how important they are, and zone 2 is kind of like the opposite of that in a way. But
it's completely the opposite. And, of course, I did this kind of work also because in the first place, okay, I did some cycling, as I said. I'm a fan of cycling in one way. But actually, I'm the biggest fan of the human body. It's crazy what our human body is capable of, how adaptive it is. We all think it goes not fast enough, but it's crazy what happens into the body when you just take someone and you just put 10 to 12 weeks of training into it, how adaptive it is. If you never rode a bike and you do it for 12 weeks, your oxygen carrying capacity on the HB mass and things, it goes up. It almost doubles with some people. It's crazy how the body actually does that. And then you had that attention, which I of course followed on the zone 2 training, which comes from an athlete, Tadej Pogačar, and his coach mainly. An exceptional athlete, to say it in the first place, and with different goals. It's a GC rider, Grand Tours, completely the opposite on what we try to aim for as a team, and with a crazy aerobic capacity, just genetically, in my opinion. I don't know Tadej his detailed numbers, of course, but so yeah, if I will say it differently, if we had to do only zone 2 training within our team, I think when we hit second time Quaremont in Tour of Flanders, I don't know if there is, except from Mathieu, based on talent and also same as the Pogačar, I don't know if there is still something left, someone left, with all respect. So based on the goal and also genetically the level of talent, we have to work on that anaerobic capacity to survive certain decisive moments in racing. And of course, there is a lot to say for that zone 2 training. If you have, if you want to, as a non-professional, you want to build up general fitness and put the first steps, and then it's correct. But in professional cycling, I'm still convinced that you also need that amount of extra specific work on top of that. And in my opinion, you see that now also a little bit happening. I think someone like Tadej changed a little bit the methods also the last 1.5 to 2 years. And it was better that he stayed with his old training, in my opinion, because now he's too good. Yeah, zone 2 training, it's not the... I understand the principles in one way, but it's not the magical key to say, hey, just stay in your zone 2 training and forget all the rest. That's maybe a bit short.
That's a fair point. And I guess looking to the future, last question, Christoph, because I know you're busy at your pre-season training camp. We've seen kind of, it feels like in the last even 5 years, there's been quite quick change in pro cycling, and the boundaries are being pushed further and further. Speeds are higher. We're seeing some incredible performances. What part of that's been noted as, you know, riders fueling more? Where do you see the sport going? Do you think we've kind of reached a plateau now, or is there space for performances to increase further in the future?
Actually, it's a question that I don't know the answer to, because we had that small discussion yesterday. 10 years ago, we had something like let's take a quite normal athlete, normal average body weight, somewhere between 70 and 75, whatever. But the 500 watt border for 5 minutes, just on absolute power, that was something. That was something 5 years ago, for sure 10 years ago. now you see athletes who are doing 10 minutes 500 watts. On absolute power, it's quite crazy that the body can just produce that. So I think, 10 years ago, you would have something like, 10 minutes, 500 watts, is that possible? Is that how do we have to look at that? But the specific nutrition and all the specific preparations, altitude camps, the knowledge that we gather around that, it makes athletes better, more targeted. I don't know where it's actually going to. Of course, I think we are a bit at the limits of the maximum carb intake now. But okay, that was also something which we said, 15 years ago. When I was in college, I still remember that they said, okay, it's 1 gram a minute. So it's 60 grams an hour. You cannot do more. Now we are doing almost three double already.
Wow. Is that something you would see your riders kind of looking to consume per hour in a race?
There are riders capable of 120 to 150 grams an hour when it comes on to racing. Yeah. So when the stomach and mainly the gut, when it's quite good trained on the absorption of it, then you see, for sure, over 120. Slightly towards 150 for really one, the big events where you targeted, yeah.
And I think as well, a lot of these big performances have come from very young riders. Pogacar is the perfect example of that. Is there like a lot of pressure and a quite a big drive to find these younger riders who are coming through, who are going to step onto the scene at 19 and straight away put down these like landmark performances?
I think, it's a bit of a double thing, but a couple of years ago, they just did a bit their own thing. I think in one way, it's good that the young riders have some kind of professional environment quite soon in their career development. But on the other hand, we have to make sure that we don't overact in all those situations. And it's a bit of an advice to all those young athletes. They lose a little bit the subjective feeling on what riding a bike sometimes is. We have some kind of small games there as a coach, where you sometimes say to the athletes, hey, can you now do 5 minutes, 400 watts, but without any power meter? Or we just tape it, whatever. Experienced athletes are really good on just putting that down. The same with just putting the heart rate away and asking themselves after a certain effort, what do you think your heart rate is now? They know it with maximum 3 or 4 beats off, because they still have the subjective feedback loop on, okay, this is my ventilation. The effort should feel like that. This will be, I'm pretty sure that I now just pushed out about that power. If you take the computer away from a 19-year-old or 20-year-old kid which just comes into the team, it's big panic. Really big panic. And of course, the power meter is the basic instrument of modern cycling. We need it. We all need it. The nutritionist needs it. The coach needs it. The athlete, we all need it. But don't try to lose the subjective feeling and all the feedback loops that happen into your body. Try to feel them. Try to be a bit aware of it. I think if you have that kind of mix, you have the biggest chance to get really far in modern cycling.
Great advice, Christoph. Really great advice. And it's been fascinating to talk to you and hear your insights into the pro peloton and also how you do things at your team. So thank you very much for your time. Just a quick reminder, you can watch a full season of bike racing live on Discovery Plus and Max to keep track of how this year's season develops for Christoph and his team. There you go, really fascinating to hear from Christoph. And I learned quite a lot actually speaking to him. He actually used to be my coach back when I first moved to Belgium. And it seems like since then, well over 10 years ago, it's remarkable how much the sport has progressed.
But let me know what you think in the comment section down below. Always really interested to hear from you. And also let us know who you'd like to try and hear from next and who we could try and get on the channel. Thanks for watching, everyone. See you on the next one.